You're listening to the Matt Mercer Live Radio Network.
Matt Mercer Live. Imparting wisdom to the masses on a daily basis.
Matt Mercer Live.
Get ready, America.
It's time
for Matt Mercer Live. In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Jacksonville, North Florida, and realms beyond. June 22nd, already upon us, a hot one today. You're listening to Matt Mercer Live, where we help you make sense out of the law. Good luck with that, making sense out of the law. We have 5 different courts of appeals here in Florida. You would think if the law was straightforward, we might only need one, but we have 5. So anyway, we're here in the jurisprudential bunker, broadcasting in 100,000 watts of radio power from News 104.5 WOKV, and I'm joining you during your dinner time drive. Now, let's get into a couple of legal topics, but before we do, I want to tell you there's 2 ways you can plug into the show with your questions. You can email your questions. Let me grab our little email address here. It's a lot of letters. WOKV, the call signs of our station, WOKV at mercerfirm.com. Grab your pencil. You can email your questions 24/7, by the way, not just during the show. I've got a question that we got back on June 8th from Heather. I'm going to read in just a minute. But the email address, WOKV at mercerfirm.com. That's mercerfirm.com. And the second way to plug in with your questions, you can check us out on the web at the show's webpage. Go to www.mercerfirm.com/WOKV. And there is the page. You can scroll down, submit your questions that way as well. So, number of topics we're going to talk about tonight, but I did want to read an email that we got from a person. I'll just read her first name, but it's from Heather. It's back on June 8th. I was out last week. We had company in town. So those of you who were tuned in got a wonderful encore performance that Tom ran for us. Here's the email from Heather. Quote, "My husband and I were actually discussing yesterday what happens when a crime is committed in international waters on a cruise ship. We weren't sure if it was the country of debarkation, the country of the ship's registry, or someone else who would handle the investigation slash prosecution of these crimes. Just curious, Heather." All right, that's June 8th. We're going to get into that. There's a number of things that matter. First of all, if a crime happens on a cruise ship, it depends on where the ship is. Now, she says in international waters. Let's touch on that briefly. First of all, obviously, if a cruise ship, and so many of them are registered in Liberia, the country of Liberia, so they fly the flag of the country of registry, right, if you're a cruise ship. And if they are in the internal waters of a nation, let's say they're pulled into port, then obviously they're going to be subject to the laws of that nation, of that sovereign. Now, let's go a little further out from port. What happens if they are, let's say, within 12 miles of the border of the nation? That's the internal, the territorial waters of the nation. And there you've got a situation where you've got the laws of the nation applying there as well. So that's why sometimes cruise ships will wait until they get more than 12 miles out before they allow gambling, if gambling's illegal, et cetera. Okay, so we go beyond 12 miles, and now we're in this contiguous zone. This is that zone, let's say, between 12 miles out and 24 miles out. And this is an interesting zone because, obviously, the Coast Guard still has jurisdiction. They can board, you know, any ship that's in this contiguous zone, even if it's flying the flag of another nation. But where is the, what I'll call the sweet spot for territorial waters? You go more than 24 miles out, generally. And now you're in, international waters, 24 miles and beyond. And now if there's a crime committed, this gets right to Heather's question from her email. Now you're going to be subject to what? Great question. She's like, "Are you? If it left from Port Canaveral here in Florida, does that mean that the laws of the state of Florida, as far as the criminal law and the prosecutorial power of Florida, is that what's going to apply?" The answer is no. Unfortunately, you're going to be subject to the criminal law and the criminal investigatory powers of the country, you know, where that ship is registered. So if it's registered in Liberia, congratulations if you're the victim of a crime. And this is a real problem in one sense, because so many crimes that happen on cruise ships end up not resulting in any prosecution at all. Okay, so, but fortunately, most of the cruise ships are well run, and most of the time you have a great time. But there are crimes. So it's a very good question. Again, if you want to email your question, send it 24/7 to wokv@mercerfirm.com. Okay, a number of things we're going to talk about tonight on top of that. First thing I want to mention is if you're entering into, let's say you're wanting to go and you think you want to buy something, and I'm going to make up a hypothetical. Maybe you're thinking about, you're musing over maybe buying a boat. Maybe for you it's an RV. Maybe for you it's a piece of land. Maybe it's a house. Maybe it's a car. And it's one of those things where you're not an impulsive person. You want to think about it. And you ask the seller, let's just use a car just to stick with the example. You ask the seller, could I think about it over the weekend? And the seller says, absolutely. And you say to the seller, you're the prospective buyer, okay, will you promise not to sell it to anyone else? Okay. He says, yeah, I promise. I won't sell it to anyone. If you get back to me by noon on Monday, I will hold it until then. Let's pretend that's what the seller says. Are you good? Let's say you go back. You talk to your friend or your spouse or whoever, and you're saying, you know, I think I'm going to get this. It's a great price. It's a great car. Low mileage. Awesome. Maybe it's your dream car. And you're hesitating, but you're thinking, I'm safe because I've got this thing locked in until Monday. Do you? Do you think you do? Do you really? Maybe not. You think you have an option contract, but you've got a problem. So I'm going to tell you what that problem is, and then I'm going to give you some examples here on Matt Mercer Live of what you can do to avoid that problem. So first of all, if you're dealing with an option contract, and that's what it is, you're not bound to buy it. You're just reserving the option to buy it for a specified period of time. Now, in my hypothetical, it's verbal. You can't really rely on verbal, not because the verbal didn't happen, and not because you might not be able to prove that the verbal didn't happen. What if there were, for example, what if there's a verbal, the same verbal transaction where, can I have till Monday at noon to think about it? And the seller says, sure, I'll hold it. I promise I won't sell it to anyone else. And let's say you have a bunch of witnesses. I mean, you've got a priest, a rabbi, a judge, a notary. I mean, a lot of very dignified, wonderful people, and they're all witnessing this conversation, right? No shortage of witnesses. You still have a problem. And your problem is really twofold. First of all, we have this thing in Florida as well as most other states, and it goes all the way back for many of you who email me. I know a lot of people are kind of interested in legal history, and, you know, 49 of our 50 states trace their law back to what we call the Old English common law. Louisiana is a little different. Some would say in many different ways, but yeah, they're sort of Napoleonic code over in Louisiana, a little bit different source of their law. But the English common law, what came over on the Mayflower, right? The foundation of a lot of our laws. And we have this thing called the Statute of Frauds. It sounds like a scary criminal concept, but it's really a civil concept. The Statute of Fraud says that certain contracts have to be in writing in order to be enforceable, or disjunctive or. I get emails from law students, so I love trying to bring a little bit of clarity to it. If there's not a formal contract per se, as long as there is some memorandum, some note, some writing, doesn't have to be a full-fledged contract, that's signed by the party against whom enforcement's going to be sought. That's the other guy to the transaction. If you're selling land, for example, the seller has to sign either the contract or some memorandum agreeing to sell the land at a certain price signed. It could be on a cocktail napkin, right? Doesn't have to be a formal contract. Now, if you don't have that, if you're stuck with verbal, you're going to have a problem, because the statute of frauds would prevent you from, in many cases, prevailing. Oh, I know. I know first-year law students that are listening. There are some exceptions, like what happens if there's partial performance or in some states full performance. Yeah. We don't want to get too technical. Let's get out of the weeds and get onto the main interstate here with a point that if you're doing an option contract to buy a car, if the price of that car is over $500, verbal's not going to be good, because the statute of frauds also applies to the sale of goods that are more than $500 here in Florida. And by the way, in most other states, sale of goods more than $500, if the seller backs out and it was just a verbal contract, may not be able to recover if you have to sue the seller. So if it's over $500, there needs to be a writing. Okay, there's a second problem with an option contract, and this is the one that a lot of people miss. So even if you have a writing, let's say you pull out this piece of parchment and your little pen, and you say, okay, let's write this up, Mr. Seller. Okay, I'm get to think about it for the weekend, and by noon on Monday, you promise you won't sell it to anyone else as long as I get back to you by then. Okay, and you both sign it. Now, there's a second problem, and this is why the law is complicated, because it's not always intuitive. And that's the real unfortunate thing, because the second problem here is that you've got to have what we call consideration. Now, this is a complete departure from what most of us think. Consideration doesn't mean being nice and considerate. Here, this is like in the mixing bowl of creating an agreement or an option contract in this case. You've got the flour and the sugar and all this other stuff, but you got to have the eggs, right, in the mixing bowl to cement what you've got. And that's what consideration is. So what do I mean by that? Let me break it down. If you have a writing, get the seller to sign it, agreeing not to sell the vehicle, the boat, whatever the item is, the land, whatever, until a certain date, and write down what the purchase price, the option price, or what some will call the strike price. Put that in the writing as well. Seller needs to sign it, but you got to give them a little bit of money. That's what I mean by consideration. Don't give them a quarter. That may be nominal consideration, may not be adequate. Give them $25, give them $100, depending on the value. It needs to be some legal consideration. It doesn't have to be consistent with the value of the item. Okay, so there you go on that. Option contracts can be enforceable. And you know what? What I recommend to folks at my law firm, Mercer Law, option contracts can be great in so many contexts that people don't always think of. For example, let's say you're going to rent a home. You've moved here from another state. You're welcome to Jacksonville, by the way. Welcome to Florida. And, you know, you're living with the in-laws, and you're ready to rent a home or rent a condo. Why not put an option contract, an option to purchase it? If this house is good enough for you to rent, you may not think you want to buy it today. But why don't you put a provision in that contract that would allow you, you're leasing it month to month, month to month, but you have the right during the term of the lease, if you write this in there and everybody signs it, you can maybe put a purchase price in there, because maybe later you love the house, you don't want to move. And if you do that on the front end, that's where your bargaining power is with a landlord. Landlord's got a vacant house, they're wanting to lease it, and you're a tenant. Hey, put the option in there, even if you don't exercise it, even if you never want to exercise it, it can still open up options later. Also, if it's freely assignable. I'm attorney Matt Mercer of Mercer Law. We're going into a commercial break. Be back in a few.
Broadcasting in a whole bunch of watts of radio power. You're listening to Matt Mercer Live. Matt Mercer Live.
Matt Mercer Live.
Listen a lot to learn a lot. You're listening to Matt Mercer Live with your host, Matt Mercer. Get ready, America. It's time for Matt Mercer Live.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to Matt Mercer Live. I'm attorney Matt Mercer all day long, broadcasting from News 104.5 WOKV, the jurisprudential bunker, rounding third base. This is the dinner time drive, fastest half hour of your week, as we cover more and more legal topics, helping you make sense out of the law and run your business smarter, be safer, more safe as a consumer, et cetera, et cetera. Hey, by the way, what to do if you get a request for sworn statement of account? If you're in the construction business, you're a sub or your material supplier, and you get the owner sends you what's called a request for sworn statement of account. Don't cast that aside in your inbox, especially if you're not that familiar with lien law. You may want to talk to an attorney, because you can lose your lien rights if you're a builder and maybe not get paid. So there's a lot of little tricks and traps in our Florida lien law that both the lienors can do, the builders can do, and also the owners can do to try to trip up each other. That's a simple way of putting it. Number of other things we're going to try to cram in here. First of all, what is a demand letter? What's a demand letter? What does it mean when you get a knock at the door and there's a certified letter and you open it up and it's law firm letterhead? What do you do? First of all, what is that and what is it not? When you get a demand letter from a law firm, or if you are, let's say, a small business owner and you're having a problem with another business or maybe with a commercial customer, maybe you're not getting paid, maybe somebody needs to cease and desist, the letter, I like to say the pen is mightier than the sword. A demand letter, even if you have had months of frustration trying to solve this problem on your own and the other side's not taking you seriously or they're ignoring you, sometimes hiring an attorney to do a demand letter can be very, very beneficial. So what is a demand letter? A demand letter is not a lawsuit. There are a number of people who call my law firm here in North Florida and they'll say, hey, Mr. Mercer, I just got served with a lawsuit. What do I do? And we have them come in and we look at it. It's not a lawsuit. It's just a letter. A letter is not a lawsuit. A lawsuit will look very different. It'll have a summons. It'll have a complaint. It's going to look a lot more formal. It'll have a case number. But a demand letter isn't a suit. Now, it's often a precursor to a suit. So when attorneys send a demand letter, for example, if I have a small business owner and they're owed a debt by another business or by a customer, let's say $10,000, $15,000, $150,000, the logical first step for me as an attorney is not to go file a lawsuit. It's to try to resolve it, short of that, with an attorney demand letter on law firm letterhead. Now, the question when I'm drafting one of these, I always use the dog analogy. Because at Mercer Law, let's face it, we are a dog-friendly law firm. We love dogs. We do not like cats. I'm sorry, cat owners. Go to the competition up the street. They love cats. We are a dog-friendly firm. And I always tell people, I can do a bulldog demand letter, and I explain, bulldog demand letter is what you'd think. It has a lot of bite, okay? Or I can do a softer demand letter, maybe a little bit more diplomatic. One, I would say, it's not a bulldog. Is it a poodle? Or maybe a Bichon Frise, something really cute. No, not really cute, but something that doesn't necessarily threaten a lawsuit, right? We can go to either extreme. I always tell people, sometimes the first attorney letter maybe is a little bit of the version that it has a little bit less bite, because I can always turn the volume up later with the second letter, but I can't dial it back. If I come out with a bulldog demand letter, I usually, the approach that I take, I've already gotten the facts, I've gotten the background, the history, and I know the law. So I'm going to package all that together in a demand letter to send to your adversary, the person or business that you're having a problem with. And I'm either going to demand that they comply with a contract, that they cease and desist their unlawful competition or whatever it is that they're doing wrong, or if they owe you or your business money on an unpaid debt. That's the wonderful power of the letter, because so often the demand letter gets their attention in a way that you weren't able to. And that's just because when they get something where you've lawyered up and now they're getting something on law firm letterhead, it's a game changer for many people, because now they realize, wow, the next step is this lawyer in the letter is telling me I'm going to get sued and may well, right? So that's the power of the demand letter. And I always tell people, many times it depends really on the temperament of the offending party, the adverse party, whoever's violating, the terms of the deal or the terms of the contract. Or maybe it's a business partner who's taken advantage of you, right? Or is pilfering the assets of the business, self-dealing, breach of fiduciary duty. You name the offense, whatever that is. The demand letter, if you can, with one letter, get them to comply, get them back in line, that can be a really inexpensive remedy, right? Not only solving the problem, but doing it inexpensively without a lawsuit. And so that's why I always recommend, not always, there are times where you need to tactically or strategically pounce with a lawsuit first thing, right? If you have somebody who is, for example, playing with real estate and they're trying to, maybe they are trying to, you're under contract to buy some land and the seller won't close, we may need to file a lawsuit to tie up that land before they sell it out from under you. It depends. I'm attorney Matt Mercer of Mercer Law. We'll be back next week. You can find us on the web at www.mercerfirm.com. Have a great one.
Matt Mercer Live, helping you get even smarter.